is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, December 5th, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. In its newly tabled budget, the federal government announced that over the course of 4 years, there would be a $2.7 billion reduction in international assistance. As Bridget Pataski writes in her November 13th piece on Rabble.ca, this announcement has drawn the ire of NGOs who warn it could cause long-term, irreversible harm, leaving vulnerable communities without essential medical care, food, and protection at a time when global needs have dramatically risen. This week on Rabble Radio, we tune into her conversation with the Director of Policy and Advocacy with Cooperation Canada, Paul Farron. Cooperation Canada is an umbrella group representing more than 100 Canadian nonprofits engaged in humanitarian aid efforts and international development. Here are Bridget Pataski and Paul Farron in conversation. Take a listen.
So I wanted to talk to you today about the federal government's recent announcement that they would be cutting $2.7 billion from foreign aid, specifically targeting global health development programs. This would be over the course of 4 years. And I wanted to highlight this in the face of the Trump administration's dismantling of the United States Agency for International Development. We know from recent reports that hundreds of thousands of people have already been suffering from cuts to USAID. And The Lancet recently released a study saying that 14 million people could die if these cuts hold. So I want to talk about how, in the face of the already existing international cuts to humanitarian aid, how NGOs have been operating with reduced capacity from a lack of other partnerships, and how the recent announcement of additional cuts from our own government could potentially spread NGOs very thin in terms of their operations.
Yeah, I mean, the first point, perhaps to nuance, is that, yes, there has been a pretty dramatic shift in U.S. policy in terms of their role on international development. What we're seeing in Canada does not equate with what's happened in the U.S. So just to nuance that a little bit. There's also been cuts from a number of other countries in Europe as well, in France and in the U.K., which also seem to be a bit more important than what we're seeing here. Although here there is a bit of a lack of transparency in terms of what the size of the envelope is. We know how much is being saved, but we're not really certain from which envelope or the size of the envelope from which it is being saved. It is obvious that, you know, with the reductions in international assistance happening globally, that that's having an impact on people and communities. Of course, NGOs, civil society organizations will be impacted. But at the end of the day, as you've mentioned, it's really about people. It's about, you know, mothers having the capacity to have safe pregnancies. It's about children being able to grow up healthy. It's about treating or preventing diseases. So there's lives behind these numbers that we're seeing slashed. It is a bit difficult right now to measure the exact impact of that. First of all, on the Canadian side, the budget was just released, and we're still seeking clarity on how that will be operationalized. So what do these cuts actually mean? To what extent do these cuts apply to official development assistance, or do they apply to other aspects that Global Affairs Canada runs, be it foreign missions or whatnot? So there's a lot of question marks as well, and that's a point that we will keep discussing with the government on to ensure we have clarity, and to also offer advice from the sector in terms of how best we can operationalize the envelope that we have.
Is the ambiguity in the announcement alone, does that interfere with NGOs' ability to plan for the long term when they don't know what kind of environment in terms of their budget that they'll be operating in?
Well, I mean, I think there's an assumption that whatever agreements there are between individual organizations and the government will run their course. However, what follows beyond that, absolutely. We don't know what the actual priorities are in terms of how this budget will be operationalized. You know, obviously the budget was just dropped. We are aware as well that there's been quite a storm for this country to weather over the last 6 to 9 months. So international development is one of those, but this country is facing a lot of challenges in terms of affordability, in terms of housing, in terms of other issues that this government is trying to deal with, at least. But yes, I mean, in short, it does add uncertainty. So again, I mean, that is a point of advocacy that we're coordinating with the sector on. If you would have seen our press release as a sector that we issued, we had over 100 of our members and a sister coalition called CanWatch, with whom we kind of jointly drafted this press release. So the sector has kind of rallied behind these points. You know, we're kind of seeing this in the same manner in terms of cuts, number one, being short-sighted, and secondly, that there is a need for a bit more transparency in terms of what we're cutting from, but also in terms of what these priorities mean. On the health bit that you mentioned, I think it's important to add that Canada has been a leader in global health, and that is a good thing. We've had a leading role on maternal health, on child health, on treating diseases, on preventing diseases, on AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, and so on. I think the rationale we saw in this budget in terms of reducing that funding for global health was that we were disproportionately investing in global health. I think from the perspective of the sector, that argument is perhaps a bit too easy to make. I think it is perfectly normal for countries like Canada to take a leading role in one sector versus the other. And we have seen Canada do that for global health. And again, that's a good thing. We've built networks, we've built expertise, we've partnered, we've contributed to saving lives and making communities safer. Why retreat from that? That's a question we have, and that we'll keep working with the government on.
I think oftentimes people will view humanitarian aid as purely a charitable endeavor and not something that could also benefit us. So I would love for you to explain why it's actually strategically important to engage in humanitarian funding and international development programs. Like, what benefits does it have to us?
Yeah, and that's, you know, in this moment of fiscal tightening, that's obviously a very fair and important question to ask. And I think your audience and, you know, Canadians understand that there is a need for fiscal responsibility. The first point I'll make is that international assistance accounts for about 2 cents on every dollar. So that's 2 pennies on every dollar. So it's not a massive investment. So just in terms of scope, in terms of contextualizing that, 2 cents on every dollar. The second point is that Canada is already lagging on its commitments, even before proposing cuts or savings in this budget. Canada is already far behind and lagging in its international commitments that our governments have made over, you know, you could say over the last generation. So cutting this, you know, further puts in jeopardy our global leadership and our ability to kind of take forward our vision on international cooperation. Further cutting international assistance isn't just about trimming foreign spending. It's cutting down one of the smartest and possibly most cost-effective investments Canada can make in its own security, its own economy, and its own health, you could put it that way. So when we invest, for example, in international assistance, we help to prevent crises. We help to prevent crises that may end up costing Canada and other countries even more down the line. So we're aware that wars or conflict or natural disasters will disrupt trade. Very aware of what pandemics can lead to. We're aware of what migration pressures can contribute to. So the point here is that it's much more cost effective to work towards stabilizing countries, partnering with countries, having fair trade with countries, than it is to, you know, pulling back and responding to crises when they occur. So our programs, I mean, be it on health or education or on state building, help to stabilize countries where we trade, where we invest, and where we partner. So when we step back from that role as well, it also means that others will step in and fill that gap. And we're seeing that, you know, with the retreat of the US, you're seeing other countries stepping in to fill that void. So I think there's a lot of impact that's not immediately felt, but that will eventually be felt. There's a study that demonstrates, and we've shared that with the government in our pre-budget submission, that for every dollar of official development assistance we provide, that generates $1.20 in exports for Canadian businesses. There is a study that demonstrates that for every dollar of official development assistance provided, you are saving about $60 in potential military costs or dealing with the fallout of war. I think the last point I'll make here is that, you know, beyond the what's in it for me kind of argument, this is really about what type of country we want to be, what our values are, what's the role of Canada in the world. We're not an island on our own. We're a trading country. We're a country of travelers. We're a country of foreign partnerships. So international assistance is one of those tools of our foreign policy. It's the soft power. We're seeing defense spending, you know, go up quite dramatically in this budget. And there's you know, there's legitimate arguments for that. But seeing a decrease in our soft power when we're increasing our hard power, we believe is short-sighted, not the right way to use the full potential of our foreign policy.
Just to pick up on one of the points you raised earlier in your answer, could you expand a little bit more on how our retreat and the retreat of Western democratic countries from funding international projects and humanitarian aid could open the door to countries that are not as democratic or don't have a rights-based approach in their governance to develop a relationship with developing countries, and how that could be harmful to global stability and the interests of our country?
Yeah, I mean, every country has a different context and its own unique needs. Canada has its own needs and its own reasons to seek foreign direct investments, to build its economy, to make its country safer, and so on. You could say the same thing about any country. If we are, for example, partnering in country X and we're supporting a few sectors, be it on health or on state building or on governance, we assume that there's a need for that in that country. Now, if Canada pulls out and like-minded countries pull out, well, that country will kind of proactively seek the assistance or partnership with others in order to fill those needs. So that simply, I mean, that speaks to kind of the realpolitik of influence, of partnerships, of the projection of your values as a country abroad. So that's a bigger kind of foreign policy issue. But at the end of the day, if we're kind of retreating from some of these sectors, if we're pulling back from our partnerships with certain countries, it will undoubtedly have an impact on our capacity to build those diplomatic relationships, to establish new trading partners, even to deal with potential issues that have to do with our own security as Canadians, such as, you know, containing pandemics or preventing radicalism and so on. So yes, I think you know, a thesis paper could be written to answer that question you've asked me, but just some broad strokes.
If this isn't too big of a question, I would love for you to share any insight you might have on how foreign aid and just making sure people around the world have access to the basic necessities needed to sustain human life can help prevent radicalism.
I mean, to be honest, I'm not a topical expert on radicalism, and we do have a lot of our members at Cooperation Canada, which are, but I think I could put it simply in the sense that instability will breed more instability, mm-hmm. And you know, if people and communities are in circumstances where there's a lack of the most fundamental basics that kind of allow for human dignity, then that can create circumstances where, you know, non-state actors kind of come in, and that can create circumstances where conflict breaks out. that can breed more instability, and in turn it can lead to circumstances where we're seeing more radicalism, or we're seeing radicalism being given the space to spread by some non-state groups. And we've seen that in the Sahel, in different parts of Africa and elsewhere in the world. So I think at the end of the day, a stable, secure world means a more stable and secure Canada on a number of fronts, including for our economy, for our own security, for our health as Canadians. And also in terms of just, again, as I mentioned before, just the kind of world that we want to live in as Canadians, and the values we have as Canadians.
Right. I want to ask you, how would just foreign aid cuts generally, if the budget were to be reduced substantially, how would that in particular affect the health of women and girls?
Well, I mean, Canada has been a global leader on maternal and child health, on sexual health and reproductive rights. And I mean, bottom line is, if you're removing resources from our interventions in that, then that will put in jeopardy a number of programs that we have been supporting, leading, contributing to, partnering with countries on. So in short, the government hasn't yet communicated where these cuts will occur exactly. So it's a bit difficult to determine what the impacts will be until we have more clarity on that. There is the replenishment of the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and malaria, and that is actually one of the most effective demonstrated mechanisms to treat or deal with those diseases. And we're not sure what the position of Canada will be in the replenishment of the Global Fund again. So where the cuts will be, to what extent, there are answers that we're seeking, questions that we're seeking answers to. And I think that, hopefully in the coming weeks, we'll have a bit more clarity on.
What do you think is one of the most critical programs that we really need to ensure is preserved?
I mean, that's a bit of a tricky question. I mean, I would say that we have, as Cooperation Canada, we're not necessarily a sector-specific organization. We have over 100 members that work in a number of different sectors, all of which are important to human development, to human dignity. And the budget has not, other than global health, has not really identified any kind of vision or priority. I think what is important for us as a country is to have a vision for our engagement on global cooperation, and that goes beyond looking at international cooperation as an expense, or international development or humanitarian as an expense. It is an investment towards a more secure world, and one which enables Canada to further its economic partnerships, its security partnerships, its values, and so on. So I wouldn't want to pinpoint one specific intervention or program, other than speaking about the health issue, which I've done already, because that's where they've kind of seemed to land in this budget.
And I know you've touched on this a bit throughout all of your answers, but I wanted you to expand on the types of impacts this could have on Canada's reputation if we were to retreat from our role as a leader in humanitarian aid funding and global health funding.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's unquestionable that it will not have a positive impact to either retreat or diminish our role on some of this work on international development and humanitarian work. And that is vis-a-vis our own society as Canadians, partnerships that are happening with Canadian organizations, through Canadian organizations, also partnerships happening through multilateral organizations, and also bilaterally with countries that Canada has traditionally been working closely with. So again, I think this speaks to, the kind of Canada we want to be in the world. And also, going back to the fact that these are not massive investments. We're talking 2 cents on the dollar. If you look at Canada's gross domestic product, we're talking less than 0.3% of our gross domestic product that goes into this type of investment, and that has returns for Canadians. That proven returns for Canadians and for other folks abroad. So I can't really quantify what the impact of that will be. I think that the world is disrupted right now. We're seeing a lot of disruption coming from the American administration, challenging whatever order we had in place, you know, since World War II that everybody keeps talking about. We're seeing a lot of challenges to that order, a lot of disruption, a lot of need to establish, diversify our partnerships and establish trust in different parts of the world. And we've seen the government, you know, make efforts towards that, including at the recent ASEAN summit in Southeast Asia. But I guess our message is that international assistance and that level of partnership is a tool. It's a tool in that foreign policy toolbox that we have. And it's not a tool we should look at as an expense or just some add-on. It's a tool that is good for the world, but also good for Canada.
I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Bridget, for the conversation. And with regards to Cooperation Canada, if anybody should be interested, it's easy enough. Our website is cooperation.ca. You could also find us on socials. We're most active on LinkedIn, and also on our website, where you can find our latest press releases, statements, reports that we've worked on. There's also a list of all of our members that form our from the sector. And if anyone was interested in getting in touch as well through either through social media or through our website, there's also contact information there.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day. And thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thanks to you, Bridget. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you.
That was Paul Farron, the Director of Policy and Advocacy with Cooperation Canada, and Rabble's 2025-2026 Jack Layton Journalism for Change Fellow, Bridget Pataski, in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Bridget and Paul. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. To do that, let's turn things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with national politics. The United Steelworkers Union issued an endorsement for Rob Ashton for leader of the NDP. Ashton is himself a union leader, being president of the Canadian branch of the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union, and is the only union leader currently in the race for the federal NDP leadership. The United Steelworkers endorsement of Ashton came just days after Algoma Steel in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, announced that it would be laying off 1,000 employees, most of whom are represented by the United Steelworkers. Algoma Steel had received $100 million in taxpayer money from the province of Ontario. Ashton said in response to the announced layoffs at Algoma that if he were NDP leader, he would push for legislation requiring companies to keep jobs in Canada if they receive public funding. United Steelworkers are the first major labor union to endorse a candidate in the NDP leadership race. United Steelworkers represents over 225,000 workers across Canada. In labor news, a coalition of unions in Quebec are fighting the newly enacted Law 14. Law 14 allows for an independent tribunal to rule on what services are essential during a labor dispute. Unions say that this violates a union's right to strike and can be used to force striking union members back to work. A large protest against Law 14 was held in Montreal on November 29th. This legislation is the latest example of the Quebec government trying to limit the power of unions. The Quebec National Assembly is currently considering a new bill that would make some union dues optional. Unions say this is an effort to rob their organizations of funding so that it is more difficult for them to fight back against government legislation like Law 14. Staying with labor news. This week on Rabble, columnist Tom Sanborn examined the union-besting efforts of Starbucks. In Canada and the U.S., workers at Starbucks who have tried to unionize have experienced intimidation from the company. Frédéric Martineau, who led the bid to unionize one Starbucks location in Vancouver, said that when the company learned of the unionization efforts, management came to the location and sat down each employee one by one to grill them about the union. Some Starbucks employees have been fired after trying to start a union at their store, And Starbucks has even closed some locations that have successfully unionized. In recent years, larger unions have stepped in to support the unionization efforts at Starbucks. United Steelworkers represent Starbucks employees at around a dozen locations in Canada. Also this week, as Canada strengthens ties with the United Arab Emirates, human rights groups are raising the alarm about the country's involvement in the Sudanese civil war. For more than 2 years, different factions in Sudan have been at war with one another, and there is evidence of horrific atrocities on all sides. The UN estimates that over 150,000 people have been killed in the war and 12 million have been displaced. The United Arab Emirates is a key backer of one of the rebel groups, the Rapid Support Forces, who have been linked to war crimes against parts of Sudan's black Muslim population. Canada has an arms embargo against selling weapons to any of the combatants in the Sudanese civil war, but continues to sell arms to the United Arab Emirates. Human rights lawyers held a press conference in Ottawa last week calling for an arms embargo on the United Arab Emirates to ensure that Canadian weapons aren't used in war crimes in Sudan. And finally, in provincial politics, Alberta's chief electoral officer has approved a petition calling for a provincial referendum on remaining in Canada. The issue of Alberta's sovereignty has been growing in the province in recent years, and the petition hopes to settle the issue and silence those who would wish to separate the province from Canada. The petition will now go to the Alberta Legislature, where Premier Danielle Smith's United Conservative Party will decide whether or not to hold the referendum. This creates a problem for Smith because a faction of her party are the strongest supporters for Albertan independence. If she holds a referendum, the separatists will likely lose. But if she refuses, she could upset the large group of supporters of the petition to remain. There is no word yet on when the legislature will vote on this petition. And as always, you can read about all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.